You are listening to a free podcast of the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 3rd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District. On the program today, my old pal Bill Scher of LiberalOasis.com and radio on his New York Times op-ed on how liberals win. Indeed. Also on the program today, those Colorado wildfires slowly under control. It didn't help that they are such virulent tax cutters there. Also, now we're up to about 11 Republican governors saying they will not accept the expansion of Medicaid, potentially denying millions of people health care insurance. Apparently, if you retire, if you've been struggling without work, it makes you happier. A voter purge update from Florida and a wonderful story of how just a little bit of time and maturity can turn you from a conservative shill into a thoughtful young adult. All that and more. But first, an update. There's a national gathering of Occupy Wall Streeters, or Occupy, in Philadelphia. It's day three now. Hundreds of people spoke, or I guess yesterday was day three. Today is day four. Yesterday, hundreds of marchers marching. Matt Taibbi spoke sometime around noon, and they are involved in direct actions. This will be running through July 4th. You can follow it on Twitter, the hashtag NatGat. Meanwhile, Reuters reports that law enforcement agencies, police agencies in the United States, are behind an overwhelming majority of requests for Twitter's users' private information, despite the fact that Twitter says on their service that this is your information. And this is particularly relevant in a case in New York City. Twitter's been ordered by a New York City judge to hand over 3 months' worth of an Occupy Wall Street protester's tweets. Despite the fact that the Twitter has been fighting these demands. Manhattan Criminal Court Judge Matthew Sciarrino Jr. also ruled Monday that prosecutors would need a search warrant, not just a subpoena, to get the final day's worth of tweets they seek from Occupy protester Malcolm Harris, who was arrested October 1st on the Brooklyn Bridge. Prosecutors say the messages could show whether Harris was aware of police orders he's charged with disregarding. They should also get his texts, his emails, his diaries. They should probably get everything he's ever written. Right? Why stop there? Twitter's term of service have long made it absolutely clear that users own their own account. We continue to have a steadfast commitment to our users and their rights, says a Twitter spokesperson. Maybe it's time for fake accounts. I don't know how you get away from that. Meanwhile, Mark Adams, one of eight who were found guilty of trespassing in Duarte Square back on December 17th when protesters tried to take Duarte Square that was owned by the Holy Trinity Church, began a 45-day sentence last week. He is now on a hunger strike, I guess drinking only juice. 45 days. Defendants found guilty of trespass were given 4 days community service and fines. Adams' extra charges earned him a prison sentence. And the presiding judge sentenced Adams to 15 days longer than the 30 days asked for by the prosecution and cited the foundational importance of private property in his ruling against these 17 protesters. December 17 protesters. We have a guy in jail for 45 days for daring to trespass on a church's empty lot. Oh, can't you just feel the beauty of religion permeating through you? All right, folks, we got to take a break. We'll be right back with Bill Scheer. Well, Matt just told me a very funny story about that Malcolm Harris character whose tweets are being demanded in a wholly in unrelated story. He's very upset about my comments about my daughter on Twitter, but we can talk about that in the better half of the program. Because now, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program my old friend Bill Scheer of liberaloasis.com. Bill, hello.
Great to be back on. Now, Sam, I can talk to you unshackled, unfettered. But we can just have this out.
Why now? Why now as opposed to any other time?
Because I've laid my cards on the table in this little rag called the New York Times.
Never heard of it.
It publishes some real hacks like Tom Friedman and Maureen Dowd.
It's true.
It's the only publication that would deign to reprint my scribble, and I have made a case to those who feel that Obama has been too weak, or Obama's been a corporate tool of Wall Street, and I don't understand why he doesn't just summon the spirit of FDR and LBJ by pointing out that the whole notion of compromise with corporate interest was pioneered by FDR, and also echoed by LBJ.
Yeah, that's right. Now, but wait a second. I want to take even a little issue with the breadth in which you're talking about this piece. I mean, it seems to me it's specifically focused on healthcare. Is that not the case? I mean,
healthcare is the biggest, but I also look at, the Recovery Act was backed by the Chamber of Commerce because they compromised on the tax cuts. Obviously, Dodd-Frank, didn't go as far as capping the size of banks, but you still got the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Food Safety Bill, which actually was a big bipartisan vote, had a number of compromises to industry. One in particular, they scrapped a ban on BPA.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you something, Bill, about that.
Yeah.
Let's start with the smallest first. I mean, are you really happy about this BPA? I mean, it seems to be widely accepted that this is highly toxic, this stuff.
I'm not pro BPA, but these are the tough situations we're all dealt with. If you have a situation where it's a choice between empowering the FDA to recall tainted food, but not have a ban on BPA, or get nothing, what do you do? And I think a lot of folks now have taken the attitude, hold no quarter, draw a stiff line. If you don't win today, if you just fight harder, you'll get it tomorrow, and it'll quote FDR and LBJ or something along those lines. But if you actually look at the history of the New Deal and the Great Society, that's not the attitude that they took in the legislative process. And there are more examples. There are things I could cherry pick that would undercut me. I agree with that. We can talk about that. But I do think if you look at the sweep of it, when you take on corporate interests just flat out, hold no quarter, you know, Clinton and healthcare, Carter energy, not only do you lose the immediate issue, but you sap your political capital. You are unable to pursue additional progressive reform in other areas because you've made yourself politically toxic. And on that specific issue, you've scared the hell out of the politicians, and they don't want to deal with it for another 15 years. Whereas when you make the deal, I mean, not as any old deal, but a good deal, to get FDR and his Recovery Act. This is his first 100 days, one of his first big things. He's dealing with the Chamber of Commerce about, I want to have some labor reform, I want minimum wage, I want maximum hours, I want collective bargaining rights. And they say, well, we want to suspend antitrust law because we want to fix prices to get us out of it. That's what we think needs to be done to get us out of the Depression. And that was a big deal to suspend antitrust law. And it was a fight in the Senate, but the FDR said, I'll do that deal. And if he didn't do that deal, and you could argue that wasn't a great deal, that fixing prices didn't help very much. But he got the ball rolling on the labor reforms that they could not stop. It just kept building and building and building. So getting something done gave you the momentum to build on. Off of getting nothing done puts you in status quo for a very long period of time.
Okay, well, now I'm going to agree with the general premise that in the main, negotiations and getting buy-ins is very important to move forward. But there's a couple of things here that I think are a little bit problematic with your argument. When you use, let's say, Bill Clinton as an example, you're talking about a guy who got into office with less than a majority of Americans, who came in essentially more or less at a time where the economic recovery was starting. There was not necessarily a huge mandate for him to do health care per se. And so it's not necessarily analogous to the situation that faced President Obama. I mean, because presumably you would agree that there's a difference between that we can actually have a good deal or a bad deal. Right? I mean, it's not just a deal, like you said.
Correct.
You got to have a good deal. And like when you cite...
I mean, something that significantly moves the ball forward, that's not papering over a problem.
Okay. And when you cite... And it's very difficult to argue in theory or hypothetical that there was a better deal to be had in certain situations, right? But we do know the context in which... President Obama entered office was very different from Carter or from Clinton in terms of...
Carter got off in a better place than Clinton. Carter got in, his approval ratings were very high at first.
Just talking about approval ratings. We're talking about a mandate and on what they ran on and the general mood in the country. I mean, it's...
Well, Clinton ran on health care.
Well, listen...
He got elected with less votes. I grant you that, but healthcare was something he significantly ran on.
I understand, but I don't think that there was in the country necessarily, and I think that's indicated by the fact that he got less than a majority. I don't think there was anything comparable to the mood in the country that we had been cheated by the establishment. I mean, could you make the argument that the ground was nearly as fertile for Carter or Clinton for some type of wholesale change?
I would agree with you that Obama had more of a mandate on health care than Carter on energy or Clinton on health care. But he did not have a mandate for the specific programs that certain folks on the left want. He did not have a single-payer mandate. He didn't have a public option mandate.
Wait a second. I mean, it's very hard to argue he didn't have a public option mandate. He was the one who was arguing for it in the...
I seriously disagree on this point. There's been a lot of revisionist history on this. I've been very involved in this subject. I don't speak on behalf of Campaign for America Street Tree here, but I do work with them, and we were involved in this issue. The policy paper that Obama put out as a candidate had public option in it, but it was very buried. It didn't even have a. It literally did not even have a title. It was done in a very oblique way, and he did not run ads on it. It did not come up in any debate versus McCain. It came up very in a cursory way when he was fighting Hillary Clinton over individual mandate.
Well, because she also subscribed to a public public option.
What happened was Edwards bit first. Edwards took public option. And really try to run on it. And Hillary and Obama then picked it up so there'd be no daylight between them. But neither one of them ran on it very strongly. And when Obama got the nomination, he did not run on it at all.
Let me ask you this. What did you perceive when Obama talked about change? I mean, we're going to limit this conversation to just about this type of policy as opposed to civil liberties, because I think
that's not a corporate issue.
That's not a corporate issue. And I think that's ground where I think you would agree the ground is a lot shakier to support Obama in that instance. I mean, can we just agree on that?
I would not agree on that on the surface, but I think it's a separate matter than all this corporate stuff.
Okay, it's a separate matter. I won't force you to. We won't have that argument. Maybe in 10 minutes we will. But let's stay here with this corporate stuff. What did you think he meant by change?
What I think he meant. Look, this. I think it actually came up in the primaries in a bit of a subtle way, because Edwards would say, you know, we got to take these people on and beat them and beat them and beat them again. I think I'm quoting him, you know, close to verbatim. And then Obama would follow that, and he would say, you know, we got to tell the special interests, you can have a chair, but you can't buy the whole table. And people would applaud to the same amount for both, but they're actually different arguments. And Obama was saying, you know, I am going to talk to these people. I'm not going to shut the door. I'm just not going to let them run the whole show. And that's exactly what he did. And there's a difference between how Clinton handled health care, which literally was that, I mean, the health insurance, in both cases, the insurance lobby played a double game where they were funding ads, trying to defeat it, but also trying to talk. Because in both cases, they thought, a bill's probably going to happen. We want to make sure it's not too bad for us. And Clinton's people, by and large, would not meet with them. And when they would not meet with them, they said, the fix is in for us. They want to put us out of business. You know, we're going scorched earth on them. And Obama's case, very early on, they said, hey, we're here to talk. Just stay inside the tent. Don't try to kill this whole deal. And, you know, yes, they did fund Chamber of Commerce as trying to defeat it, but it was nothing like the Harry and Louise campaign. This is
now, why do you think,
to both sides.
Why do you think that as early as the 90s, early 90s, the insurance industry knew that something was going to happen?
I mean, as you know, Clinton got 43% of the vote, but his majorities in Congress were about as big as what Obama had to work with. And Clinton's honeymoon period, at first, it was short, but initially he entered office with a pretty high approval rating. So they thought he had some mojo to work with in his first term. But once the Harry and Louise campaign started, which was really brutal, and Hillary Clinton at one point said, this campaign is full of lies and misinformation, and don't believe it. All that did was just help the insurance lobby raise more money and quintuple their ad budget. So he got drowned out to the point where the Democrats in Congress were so scared that every bar was built for votes. And the Obama strategy was very different from that. And so my beginning of my Ryan's piece was noticing that difference and trying to tease that out. I was thinking that I was going to go back and look at FDR and LBJ and not find parallels and have to talk about historical differences. The media was different and the structure of the Republicans was different and all that sort of thing. And I was shocked to find that there actually were a lot more parallels than I had suspected.
Now, let me ask you this, Bill. Now, hold on for a second. I don't want you to filibuster here. I know that because, you know, I don't have commercial breaks. I'll keep you for an hour and a half and I'll just let you talk yourself out. I mean, I think, you know, if there was pressure on the insurance industry, and the insurance industry, from, you know, conversations I've had with people like Wendell Potter, they understood that they had basically a broken business model. And they had been seeking this mandate, as you know, since that time, since the early 90s. And maybe it was a mistake for liberals not to take it then, right? I mean, maybe they should have embraced Bob Dole's proposal back in 1993.
Or Nixon's in the 70s.
Yeah, perhaps. But the point is that there was a general awareness that the insurance industry certainly was aware of it, that their business model was basically on the verge of a death spiral. As you had Americans getting older, it's going to put more pressure on health insurance because your risk pool becomes riskier. And so the question is how much leverage was given up early on? Now, you know, we can debate the niceties of this one way or another, but the general premise, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, if you're talking about a legislative process, in the main, I think obviously you want to have the most effective process. And if the argument is you got to buy in, you got to allow some people to buy in. But, you know, even I have no problem with. But even when you talk about FDR and you talk about that National Industrial Recovery Act, he got collective bargaining, right? Minimum wages,
right.
Maximum hours in exchange, you write, for a temporary suspension of antitrust law. So what he got was long-term reform for a short-term payoff. Now, in this instance, it seems to me that we have locked in the private insurance industry as a mechanism which is really hard now to throw off. Now, the idea of the public option was that at the very least you'd have a very short, you'd have a very small wedge in the door. In fact, I just went back and looked at, I've been perusing some of the Break Room Live videos. And back in, I think it was early 2009, Olympia Snow came out and said, we can't have the public option because it would be an unfair advantage because they'd be able to deliver a better product cheaper. I mean, so the idea, what we're talking about is what's going to lead to sort of wholesale change in the future. Now, I agree with the idea that the expansion of Medicaid brings more people into the tent, and it didn't work out as necessarily. I mean, there's a debate as to whether or not it's going to work out as well as people had hoped, because now it's quite clear that it's going to take a lot longer, probably in the instance of, you know, a state like Florida or Texas, where you're talking about several million people to institute. Most people think that it's going to eventually get there. We don't know for sure, but we do know that, you know, 11 governors have come out and said they're not going to expand Medicaid. But you know, I'm going to accept the hypothetical that we're going to see broad benefits from this healthcare bill. I mean, obviously the regulations help, but have we in some way completely shut the door on some fundamental reforms that would save people money? Because, you know, we're already seeing people thrown off of Medicare coming up in the next couple of months. We've seen President Obama put on the table cuts in Social Security. which there's no reason to believe that he's not going to put that deal back on the table. I mean, do you believe that he's going to not put that deal back on the table?
I know we're going into two different topics here, but the
point is, though, is that, you know, if we have this notion of having to cut government services, all of this ends up sort of playing on each other, right? I mean, if we enter into...
Let me put up a grand bargain just for a second. Just a few things. So the one on FDR and the Recovery Act, just to correct you slightly there, the labor reforms were not rock solid right off the bat. In fact, the corporations were very squirrely about implementing them at first. And in fact, they needed to pass, and the Supreme Court actually struck down that provision of the law in its first term, and then they passed the Fair Labor Relations Act, which creates the National Labor Relations Board, and that was a compromise. And then FDR had diluted to some degree, and some of the left were really mad at him about that.
Do you think President Obama would ever? I mean, we know why the Supreme Court reversed themselves on those laws, whatever it was, 5 years later. Right. I mean, we can both agree that President Obama would never take that type of bold action. Right. I mean,
trying to attack the court.
Yeah.
Well, he would not. But also, at a point, that's a whole separate story, because in many ways that was a big political error on FDR's part. But that's that we could. We'll go into that in a second. So anyway, the initial deal FDR had, I don't think, was quite as lopsided as you characterized it. But going to the healthcare thing, which is the more important part, I think the real question that people have is, did Obama compromise too soon and weaken his bargaining position? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I generally hear Obama start with public option and didn't really fight for it, and therefore he got individual mandate. And whereas if he started with single payer, he could have moved towards public option. Is that where you are?
Well, no, I mean, not necessarily. I mean, I think he made it quite clear in the campaign that he didn't think single payer was possible. So, I mean, he sort of took it off the table in the campaign, you know, before he even entered those negotiations, which, you know, I think is, you know, if they were talking about bombing Iran, he would never have done. You know what I mean? I mean, the idea that one could take a single payer off the table in the campaign was, well, that's perfectly reasonable.
I mean, you think that was a mistake for him to do that much?
I think it probably was. I mean, of course. You could certainly dance around the topic more than he did. He was pretty, but you know, we can get caught up on the healthcare. I think on balance, the thing is probably better than nothing. I mean, you know, I understand that to say that is sort of heresy, because you would be arguing that we would be denying these people health insurance that are going to expand on Medicaid. But at the same time, we're seeing Medicaid expenditures reduced, and you know, access to healthcare is still a big issue. I mean, it's one thing to have Medicaid insurance; it's another thing to actually get health care. But
look, this isn't fully implemented yet. So the point is that I am sure that there are imperfections in this compromise. I'm not saying that the Affordable Care Act likely solves all the problems in one fell swoop, but by doing something pretty significant. I mean, I don't think it's a ticky-tack reform. When you're saying, you know, nearly everybody in America is obligated to buy health insurance, it completely changes the paradigm of our health insurance system. On top of all the other types of, you know, payment reforms and reimbursement reforms, preventive service reforms that are going on with this, it's a whole lot of pilot projects thrown up against the wall to see which things work best to better deliver care at a lower cost. And some things are going to work well, some things are not going to work well. And if all goes well and the right people continue to get elected, you know, logical people are going to look at what works and what doesn't and make adjustments as they go.
Right.
And
I mean, it's unfortunate that we don't necessarily have can count on the idea of logical people. I mean, we're seeing already, you know, Medicaid wasn't adopted for 17 years in Arizona. It's quite possible that illogical people are going to be involved in this decision-making process too. But let's go to the broader question, okay? I mean, because you'd agree that this is essentially a bailout of the insurance industry, though, right? I mean, I don't necessarily think that outweighs the benefits that we're getting. You know, Chris Hayes has a while back, you know, analogized this to sort of, you know, you're paying off the mafia to make sure that your business isn't burned down and you're able to run a business. You still got to pay basically some protection money, but that may have better consequences than trying to fight the mafia. You can't deny this isn't a bailout of the insurance industry.
I mean, I understand you're saying about what Wendell Potter is saying, and you may be right. I don't know enough about the insurance industry to know if they were literally teetering on the edge like that. Maybe you're right. I totally agree. This is good for the insurance industry. They're going to make profits through this deal. And that's why the deal got done. That's why my whole point is these deals get done. When you can go to the affected industry leaders and say, we're not trying to put you out of business here. We're trying to help people, but we can do it in a way that's not going to, you know, kneecap you. And if you understand that, we're just trying to have some regulatory certainty and a fairer system so it's more stable and the benefits are shared more widely, you can make a profit too. Those types of deals get done. The kind of deals that say, you know what, you're the problem. We got to take you out. Go to hell.
Okay, now wait a second. Now, see, this is where I think your op-ed gets a little slippery, with all due respect, Bill. Because you're not you don't necessarily address the implication is that your piece is about healthcare, but you try and expand it into make a broader argument that Obama isn't necessarily corporatist per se. He's just from a tactical standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, he's just smarter about entering negotiations, like FDR, for instance, or like LBJ. Now, let me ask you this. Are you familiar with Barney Frank? I think he said this now in two separate interviews, that when the question of TARP came out, Barney Frank was arguing that monies should be paid directly to homeowners, to mortgage holders, as a way of essentially bailing out the banks, but doing it via the mortgage holders. In other words, the mortgage holders can turn around, take this money from the government, pay off the banks. Ostensibly, the banks get help that way. He had this argument with Paulson. Paulson said, Bush has signed off on that. I will sign off on that. But President Obama has to ask for it. President-elect Obama at that time. And according to Barney Frank, the president wouldn't do it. Now, we have a situation. I don't know if Barney Frank is telling the truth or not, but this is the only sort of story that we have. And so, when you look, I think there's, you know, I get your argument on the healthcare, and it's, you know, we're talking about a broader argument here in some level, and you try and make the case that liberal reforms are made via incrementalism, and you got to bring people on board, and I think that's, you know, I think I probably tend to agree with most of that, but if you expand it to a notion of where President Obama is coming from, and because really what we're talking about is the future, right? I mean, we're trying to sort of get a notion of how President Obama works so that we know what he's going to do in the future, right? Because, I mean, we're not just talking about, you're not writing a history piece here. I mean, we're advocating a certain position on the way that we should perceive President Obama's administration going forward, right, for a second term. And so when we see what has happened with the banking industry, where we have too big to fail banks have gotten larger, where we have seen no criminal prosecutions of any of the fraud that has taken place, when we've seen an anemic federal, at least, response to all that and the financial fraud deal, which by all accounts is anemic. And I don't think you could disagree with that, where we have federal prosecutors coming in and basically and maybe they're overstretched, but there certainly hasn't been a an attempt by the administration to push resources there by any historical standards whatsoever. I mean, when it comes to the banks and when it comes to mortgage fraud, how would you defend President Obama?
Well, first off, this is a little separate from the piece in that I think you
Oh, no, it's separate from the piece.
I think you could. It's very possible individuals will disagree with Obama's views on things. I can't make somebody agree with Obama if they don't agree. There may be things that you or your committee are disagreeing about, and that's that. And you know, the thrust of the piece is just that, as a general matter, this is how liberal reforms advance, and this is how they die.
Bill, you started this interview. Wait a second. You started this interview by saying, "I'm unshackled. I'm here to debate."
Yeah.
You don't write this piece because you want to
answer you. I'm going to answer the question directly. As we're looking at FDR, the first thing he's faced with is the banking crisis. And the people out there saying to him, "You got to nationalize the banks. This is your chance. They're on the floor. Take them out." And FDR said, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to save the banking system. I'm not going to bury it." And the liberals at the time were livid that he was leaving the money changers in the temple. And at one point, they were going to infuse them with capital. It was very TARP-like. And they told the public that we're only going to give money to the banks that are solvent. And they privately, the FDR's guys privately told the Treasury Department, "You know what, some of these banks, they're not quite so solvent. But just give them the money anyway, quietly, and look, they'll be solvent in 6 months." And they did, and they became solvent, and then the public didn't know any better.
Do you think the banks are solvent now?
There are people at the time of TARP. Like, I'm not saying...
I'm not disagreeing with TARP. I'm simply saying there was an opportunity that Paulson and Bush had signed off on, that Barney Frank had signed off on. I mean, these are guys who are fairly invested in the success of the banks. I mean, there's activists who were talking. I'm talking Henry Paulson, who was willing, who saw this as a potential remedy and was willing to go there. But President Obama was not. Now, and by President Obama, I mean his team. But he's responsible for his team.
Which he's responsible for. I don't think you exonerate him for that. It's his team.
Right.
He may be wrong. I don't know enough to say whether he's right or wrong. He may be wrong. Individuals can be wrong.
Who would be wrong in this instance? Who's wrong?
I don't think he's going to be wrong. It's very hard to say. It's easy to say if you did it my way, everything would work much better. I mean, you might be right, but I do know the way it was done. We have not had a Great Depression. The banking system has not utterly collapsed, which was a real risk.
Well, but the point is, the point is.
Maybe a commission.
Well, look, I mean, Bill. I can put a Band-Aid on something, and that may help it for a certain period of time. But by all accounts, I mean, we've had extended unemployment. There is really, I don't know of any economist who is projecting the employment situation to improve in any measurable way over the next 2 or 3 years. I mean, do you? I mean, the Fed is projecting unemployment to stay basically around the same for the next couple of years. I mean, yes, catastrophe was averted, but I imagine. But I mean, listen. Do you think? Let's for a moment accept Barney Frank's story here. Do you think that Henry Paulson was someone who was not at least thinking about the the saving the banks, and if he thought it was possible to provide homeowner relief and still save the banks. Now, I understand. Now, President Obama made it clear that the reason why he didn't go for single payer, and I'm not getting back on healthcare here. I'm trying to talk about a perspective that gives us a sense of what he's going to be like going forward, because so we have a clearer sense of where he was in the past. President Obama thought it was just simply not the American way. I'm paraphrasing, but he said it's not consistent with American values to have single payer, I think is what he said. Well, he obviously doesn't think it was consistent with American values to provide direct relief to mortgage holders, even though Henry Paulson did, or at least didn't find it so offensive that it wasn't impossible if President Obama would put on it. I mean, it seems like he was unwilling. Now, this isn't a question of anymore. We're out of the realm of industry buy-in, because when Henry Paulson has bought in, the industry has bought in.
Well, I don't
this
know
is a question of
true.
How much.
Yeah, that's a big presumption there. I don't know if Obama had a policy difference with Paulson and just didn't agree that it was going to work well, or if he had a political concern that perhaps industry was not so easily bought in as you're suggesting, and thought that was going to be a big fight that they might not win and might sink.
Well, Bill, let me ask you. Okay, let's just pretend for a moment it's 3 a.m. You've had, I know that you're a teetotaler, but you've had some chamomile tea, and I've had 14 beers. I turn to you and I say, Bill, in that decision, do you think President Obama felt he understood what was going to be better for the banks and our economy as a whole? Or do you think that he was concerned about the political implications of doing this? Which one do you think was the 51% or more that informed that decision? Remember, you've been juiced up on chamomile tea.
Every political decision is a combination of those two things. Everything that any president does is a combination of what's the right thing to do and what's politically possible. And they seem to have come down with, we need to keep the banking system afloat to avoid a total collapse.
Henry Paulson believed that. There's nothing you're saying that Henry Paulson wouldn't agree with, but the point is there was two ways to go. One had one could be done behind closed doors and a little bit more quiet and with
You're asking me a lot of questions here. Let me ask you a question. Do you think Barack Obama hates homeowners? Do you think he's completely uncaring and unfeeling how the American economy turns out, how the middle class turns out? Do you think he's 100% enthralled Wall Street? Does that jive with anything else that's happened with his agenda over the last 3.5 years?
If hate means that he did not think that it was politically best for him to provide that direct support, then yes. Now, I don't think hate means that. I just think that President Obama made a calculation that the banks, that politically he would pay a bigger price, at least in the short term, for going for providing relief directly to homeowners, even if it did ultimately salvage the banks. I think that's the calculation he made. And I think it's very hard not to argue that, because there has not been any convictions of bankers relative to like the savings and loan, let's say. And it's very hard to make the case that the only case I've heard as to why that hasn't happened is because it's hard. but you cannot make that determination because it's hard, because we know it's hard because we've had 2,000 people working on this. No, we've had 50, 75. We know that there's still tens of billions of dollars sitting in HAMP. Because the whole project was incentivize the banks to help out mortgage holders. And that didn't work, as opposed to just directly providing it for them. I think the calculation is that at the end of the day, it's better to side with the banks. And even if Henry Paulson thinks that it's a solution that could work for the economy, politically, it's better to side with the banks. And I find that very distressing. And
FDR made a similar calculation at the beginning of his term that...
A combination of
I don't think it's smart policy.
President Obama's term, he sent out his Secretary of HUD, he sent out his DOJ to strong arm state AGs who were pursuing criminal investigations against banks. At the end of his term.
That was specifically to get a settlement so they'd get homeowner assistance as fast as possible.
Oh, Bill. You could think it's a bad deal.
You could think it wasn't good on the merits, but that was the motivation behind that. There was no political gain just to kill the whole thing dead.
Are you kidding? Wait a second.
They're trying to get into the system before election day. That's what they're trying to do. They didn't want to go 4 years having nothing work. And this is the big deal here that I think you're not being fair about. They have been going at this problem in several different angles all 4 years. Yes, it's not worked as well as I would want or you want or they would want.
Bill.
They're trying to find something that works.
And I agree with you that it hasn't worked the way they want.
I think it's completely unfair and completely unrelated to everything else he's done in his administration.
Bill, go back and look at the coverage of this deal before it was signed.
I can tell you something.
I went on, and I know this. I went on, I filled in for Olbermann. I filled in for Olbermann the night before this thing was signed or on the day it was. In that office, on that day, I said, none of this money or just a fraction of the money that is supposedly going to homeowners is going to get there because the deal does not require this money to be paid to homeowners. Now, the reason why I knew that was not because I'm a banking genius. It's because it was being actively reported on. And it turned out to be the case that the vast majority of that money that was supposed to go to homeowners is now being thrown into the general funds of states.
The idea,
you cannot show me one person who's not involved with the administration who believes that deal was made to rush money to homeowners at that point, as opposed to taking it off the table politically.
Because some states have been funny about it. But the fact is, if there was no settlement at all, homeowners would get nothing.
No. That's not true. Because if there was no settlement at all and there was no administration pressure,
you'd be in the courts for years. Well, and nothing would happen today.
You would see Eric Schneiderman may have been able to cut a better deal. Bo Biden may have been able to cut a better deal. Kamala Harris may have been able
to, maybe not.
But certainly everybody who's on this beat thought that was the case. I mean, all right. We're going to have to agree to disagree on that. Let's go to the grand bargain.
Okay.
All right. The grand bargain. Do you believe the reporting that says that President Obama had had Social Security cuts on the table and was willing to accept it for the $800 billion in false revenue offered by John Boehner?
I think he has put COLA adjustments on the table.
Okay, so cuts to Social Security. Okay, I mean, you call it whatever you want. Yeah. It's cuts to Social Security on the table.
Well, let's be clear about this, though. I'm trying to be fair here. You know, you're talking about adjusting the cost of adjustment over time. So it would start immediately, but it wouldn't have that great monetary effect immediately. More over time, the gap between what you would get 20 years from now, what you would get under the deal, would be lower. And I think it is fair to say, for to argue, that's not going to be good for middle class retirees. I'm not saying something that I wholeheartedly support, but I don't think.
Would you support it at all?
I don't support it at all.
Okay. So it's not just you don't wholeheartedly support it. It's that you're against cuts to Social Security.
But I don't think it is analogous to the death knell of Social Security. I don't think it is anything akin to privatization of Social Security. It is possible that you could do that deal. It would be a hard thing to stomach.
Wait a second. Who? Wait a second. Yes, it's not as bad as privatizing Social Security. It's also not as bad as having someone hit you on the head with a hammer. But who said privatizing Social Security on the table? I seem to remember George Bush trying to do that, and he had had it handed to him.
That's correct.
Where is the pressure coming to cut Social Security, at least from the electorate? Nowhere, right?
No,
I walked around that Glenn Beck rally, and the only thing that I found that I agreed with all those nut jobs was when it came to cutting Social Security. That was like, well, we shouldn't cut that or Medicare because that already exists.
Look, it is very probable that Barack Obama has a position on Social Security that you and I disagree with. And I don't think that's about.
Do you
any kind
think
of
it's a problem?
Anybody.
Do you
he
think it's a problem?
Disagree.
Do you think it's a problem? For the Democratic brand to the extent that one exists, or the liberal brand to the extent that one exists, that the titular leader of those two areas, those two groups, is supporting cutting Social Security.
Well, if you keep talking about it like that, then yes.
What do you mean? What are you saying? It's my fault that he did this?
Well, he hasn't done it yet.
We just know that he tried to do it before, and the reason why it failed was simply because of really sort of just there were two reasons why it failed. And I would say the primary one was just dumb luck that there were six pig-headed enough senators who were like, we're going to come out with our own deal, which ended up scuttling the deal he had with Boehner. Now, it's quite possible that the Tea Party coalition and the Boehner in Boehner's caucus would have killed this too. But we've got the, you know, most liberal, progressive, Democratic president in 40 years, supposedly, suggesting that we cut Social Security. Okay, where does that leave the rest of us? How do we get involved in this argument, Bill?
Well, let's see if this deal happens and what all the aspects of the deal are and all their specifics. If this is coming up with a big shot on the arm of job creation investment, of infrastructure improvements,
we're going to cut $500 billion. I mean, if the deficit deal goes through, we're going to cut $500 billion out of discretionary spending.
I don't know what the numbers are going to be yet. They haven't done the deal.
Well, no, we don't know anything. I know, Bill, but all we're doing is we're arguing. We're assessing the past 3.5 years of the Obama administration with an eye towards what we can expect in the future. And so, I mean, yes, you and I are both. We're looking into the abyss. We don't know. All we have is what has happened in the past. Your argument is that we could theoretically get more progressive reform because this guy understands he has to deal with corporate influence and you can't fight it. And you cite historical precedent for that. And I'm saying, well, I'm also looking at the other things that he's his initiatives. I'm looking at it, and it seems to me that he's not necessarily on the side of the people that I'm on the side of.
I don't know, in this potential deal, as probably going to pretend on how well the elections go, how much of the savings against Social Security are going to come from COLA adjustments, and how much is going to come from raising the payroll tax cap. And the stronger a Democratic win in November, the more it's going to come out of that payroll tax cap than it's going to be out of COLA. The COLA adjustments might end up being very minor. They might be a lot. I don't know yet. I think it's possible that a minor COLA adjustment, which I would not support and do not think is necessary, but if it's coming along with a bunch of other things that I think are really important and really necessary, I might suck it up because life isn't fair and you do the best you can. So I'm not going to.
Let me ask you this.
Right
now, do you think Mitt Romney
organize for a better deal all you want? I think that's a great idea. Organize for the strongest deficit reduction plan possible that doesn't have COLA adjustments. I think that is a smart thing to do.
Do you think
personally now?
Do you think Democrats? Let me ask you this, Bill. Do you think Democrats, any Democrat, well, let's say 90% of the Democrats. When I say Democrats, let's agree that I'm saying 90% of Democrats. When I say Democrats, I'm talking in the House and the Senate. And I'm talking nationally, and I'm talking punditry and whatnot. Mitt Romney becomes president. Do you think there will be any Democrats? And by any, I mean, you know, maybe there's 10%, maybe Joe Manchin, who knows. But do you think that the resistance by Democrats to cuts, if Mitt Romney proposes them, will be greater than it would be if President Obama does? In other words, do you think who has a better shot at cutting Social Security?
Honestly, I think there are a lot of Democrats right now that will do this deal with whoever's elected.
Really?
Who believe that Social Security COLA should be adjusted. They just believe it.
Why? Why do you think they believe
it? Why? I can't tell you. But they want to see.
Do you think it makes it harder for people to advocate for no cuts to Social Security when the president is known to advocate cuts to Social Security?
Why is everyone's feeling so sensitive?
I'm not sensitive.
You disagree with the president, organize against the position. Do your best to hem him in. Let's be big boys and big girls here, okay?
Listen. I'm probably going to vote for Obama just based on the Supreme Court. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about what we think he's going to do and how much he hurts a progressive agenda. Now, yeah, of course. What do you think I'm doing right now? What do you think I'm doing right now? I'm doing my little bit here to argue against it. But it's important to know who we need to agitate against. And if we have to agitate against a Democratic president to not cut Social Security, that's an important thing for us to know. And people can react to that as they want. But this is not about my hurt feelings. I don't give a crap. I don't give a crap what Barack Obama, he's not hurting my feelings.
You're expressing a concern. I appreciate the concern that Barack Obama's position is not politically smart and hurts the Democratic Party. And look, you may be totally right.
It may be politically smart for him.
But you're saying it's bad for the party and bad for the issue, and I respect your opinion on that.
Wait, well, you don't agree with that? Of course you agree with it.
What I'm saying is...
Bill, wait a second. You respect my opinion on it, but give me your opinion. I appreciate you. I know how much respect you have for me.
Barack Obama is not elected, a lot of bad things happen beyond Social Security. I think it is very important that Barack Obama is reelected. I think it's the most important thing to do between now and November, more important than anything else. And I think you can fight him on the specific issues after November, after Election Day. So if I spend this time between now and Election Day attacking his personal character.
What? Wait. I'm not attacking his personal character. I have no idea what he's like as a person.
You're saying he puts politics ahead of people's homes.
Wait a second. That's an attack on a personal character?
Yeah, you're saying what's in his bones.
No, I'm not. I don't know what's in his bones. I'm talking about what his administration does. I don't know who he is. I don't care. I don't care if Barack Obama, I don't care if deep inside of him he's Mother Teresa or if he's Hitler. It doesn't matter. I'm just trying to get a clear-headed perspective on how his administration, I don't even know if it's him. For all I know, he either could be pulling the strings of every single person there, or they could be pulling his strings, or it could be anywhere in between. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care.
Take him out. Don't talk about him. Talk about the issue then. You have to even mention his name to organize around these issues.
Well, wait a second. That's like saying I'm going to organize against Simpson Bowles without trying to expose where Simpson is on this or where Bowles is on this.
I think you could. You could totally do that.
What organizing campaign are you talking about? A political campaign that doesn't peg it to a person. You know that better than anybody else, Bill.
But a good campaign pegs it to a person and demonizes that person. I mean, everybody hates that person. And I'm saying it's not a good idea to make everybody hate Obama between now and Election Day.
Well, I mean, you know, Nikki actually called into the show and more or less said the same thing to me. And I, you know, look, like I say, I think the Supreme Court is you know, perhaps the most important aspect of all of this in the final analysis. And that's why I will vote for Obama. But I mean, you know, even Ezra Klein, for God's sakes, wrote a piece that's saying from a Keynesian perspective, Romney may be better for the short-term hopes of the
economy. Ezra Klein is wrong. Ezra Klein is not the oracle, okay?
Listen, I know that. I mean, I say that I don't think I've ever necessarily followed Ezra Klein's prescriptions on matters of politics, frankly. So I will concede that aspect of it. And we haven't even gotten to civil liberties issues, which I think we can both agree Obama's been really bad on. But Romney would be worse.
I don't agree that Obama's been bad on them, and Romney would be worse.
Well, I tried, Bill.
Sam, I want you to know that I still love you.
Oh, Bill, I still love you too, of course. No, I appreciate that. I hope that goes without saying. No, I mean, you know, look, I'm going to have Glenn Ford on from Black Agenda Report, and I will probably...
you will agree that you will agree with everything that I've just said today.
I will agree with not everything that you just said, but I mean, I think I genuinely believe in the notion of the lesser of two evils, and I do think that President Obama, on balance, will be far better than Mitt Romney and a Republican Senate and House, which, if we have Mitt Romney, is almost guaranteed that we'll have a Republican Senate and House. So. But you know,
I would say further, the bigger the Democratic Congress is going to be, the easier it's going to be to fight on these issues.
Yes, I mean that is where we have absolutely no disagreement. In fact, my energy and my enthusiasm is far more with House and Senate races than it is with the presidential election.
I'd say, you know, 09 and 010 and 10 will have a lot better policy-wise than 11 and 12 because the House changed.
Yep. True. I'm not convinced that President Obama politically helped the House and the Senate situation out as much as he could have. But, you know, again,
well, I
don't think that's because
that
he's a bad person.
I think that if his lead over Romney is significant in September, you'll see a lot of resources deployed into winning the House. I think if it's very tight in September, you know, then they're going to husband their resources.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be very tight. Mitt Romney is one of the worst candidates I've ever seen, and nobody likes him.
We agree with that.
Bill Scher, always a pleasure. Folks, liberaloasis.com, they've got a radio show. what do you do?
I'm sure you'll agree that it is the finest radio show podcast in all the nation.
It's definitely the second best. Phil, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it, buddy.
Aren't you happy we did this?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. No, I had fun. And, I mean, I think, you know, look, it's, we're two sides of the same coin.
Hmm? And we're both voting for Obama.
Indeed. All right. Well, probably. I mean, I'm in New York, Bill. So, you know.
Do I go Jill Stein? Do I go Gary Johnson?
You know, I don't know. I got to see who's going to be on the ballot. If Rocky Anderson was on the ballot in New York, I'd contemplate it. Maybe Virgil Good, if he's running from the Conservative Party, just so I could do an impersonation of him.
You should do a virtual Rocky debate on the show.
Charge. What's that?
You do a virtual Rocky debate on your show.
A Virgil Good Rocky Anderson debate? Maybe. That's a good idea. All right. Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it, buddy.
No problem.
All right. I'll talk
Take
to you
care.
Soon. Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we went a little long. That was quite a debate.
Some unhappy tweets, too.
Oh, gosh. I don't have my IM on. That's about to explode. So we didn't even get to the civil rights, civil libertarian issues with Obama. But, I mean, I think that was not the ground that Bill wanted to, that Bill's piece was about. And, you know, I suppose we could argue that another time. But, you know, so there it is. I mean, we're going to have Glenn Ford on hopefully next week. Hopefully we'll be able to do that. I think maybe we'll be able to figure out, but I was going to try and have him on today afterwards, but it's probably good that we didn't. So we'd have to cut that early. And I imagine, with Glenn, it'll get just as heated somehow.
Just the other way around?
Yeah. That's what I try and do. Like I try to be right in the middle, like CNN.
Yeah, right. CNN.
All right, folks. So we're going to head into the better half of the program. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, whether you agreed with Bill or agreed with me or disagree with both of us, which I think is also quite possible, you'd be hard-pressed to find that level of debate anywhere in the mainstream media. I always said that one of the things that I, back in 2008, 2009, that I was hoping with a President Obama is for an argument between the center-left and the left in this country. It hasn't worked out quite as well as I had hoped, but, and maybe in this instance, I'm not even, maybe it was really more like the center-left versus the just left of center-left left. I don't know where I stand on that spectrum or because, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, I think Bill and I have a fundamental disagreement in our assessment of President Obama. I think that with others supposedly to my left, I'd have a disagreement in tactics, but and strategy. But nevertheless, become a member of Majority Report. You can join at majority.fm. It is your memberships that keep this show alive and make it possible for me to do every day. And the more memberships we get, the better the show will be. It's not inconceivable we will have to cut back on shows in the future. It is not inconceivable. There's so many things that are conceivable, folks. Let's not go into that realm. Just become a member today if you can afford it. If you can't afford it and you want access to the entire show, of course, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But really, if you enjoy this show on a daily basis, somebody said to me the other day, like, you should give away your whole show for free. You know, that's Marin's model. Everybody, of course, brings up Marin's podcast to me. We already do an hour's worth more free material a week than Marin's show. And we're never, look, the bottom line is Marin gets something like, I don't know, 500,000 downloads a week, maybe 400,000. If I was to get 100,000, well, 100,000 a week is not so actually. But I mean, if I was to get 200,000 a week, that would be crazy for a political podcast. Crazy. Insane. So the sponsorship model there is just highly unlikely. Unless I want to take money from institutions and groups that may have an issue with what I say. And I just would rather do nothing than do that. So please, your memberships are important to this show. And of course, you can always buy some coffee, tea, or chocolate, organic, fair trade if you want. All fair trade. Organic if you want it. With a 10% discount coupon code, Majority, at justcoffee.coop. You can buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support the show. You'll see the big Amazon link. Just click it, bookmark it, always buy your junk through there. Give us a review on iTunes, folks. Come on. I know you can do that. That's embarrassing. That's embarrassing. When I look at how many, we got like 400 and some odd reviews on iTunes. When I look at that, and I know how small a percentage it is. I don't know necessarily of our iTunes, but it's definitely small of our iTunes downloads. I just think, like, God, what is wrong with you people? You've embarrassed me. It's embarrassing. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. We'll see you in the better half.